Well, next hour, we're going to talk about technology and your future and some of the amazing things that are happening and will happen, by the way. And this is our final hour with Brian Kinnaird as we talk about Steinbeck Citizen Spy. We'll take your calls as well. And maybe you've been recruited from the by the CIA. Why don't you check in with us and tell us that story? Welcome back. We'll get to your calls in just a second here with Brian Kinnaird as we talk about the life of author John Steinbeck, Steinbeck Citizen Spy, incredible information that Brian has discovered. Brian, you were telling us about Steinbeck's son, Tom, and you were getting right into a story before the top of the hour. Go ahead.
Well, I told Tom about my research and gotten to the point where I have letters from the FBI admitting that they have destroyed portions of John's FBI file, which is a whole other kettle of worms about government agencies destroying historical documents.
That's right.
Tom asked me if I believe them. I said, no, Tom, it's a load of crap. And he said, well, that's what I always thought. And he said, the FBI hated my father, and Hoover was all over him. And we talked for a good hour or so. And over the next few months, Tom would call me, you know, every week or two, just at random intervals to see how the book was going. And he would remember things about his childhood that didn't make sense. Like in 1954, when they were living in Paris, someone from the State Department would come by every day or so and drop off an attaché case for John and then pick it back up. Tom never knew what was in it. He always thought John was up to something. He just never knew what. And one of the other things that they would do is every Thursday, John would pack him and his brother, John the Fourth, into a green Jaguar that John bought. And they would play a little game, getting lost in and around Paris. And John would take them supposedly just at random places. But Tom said it was funny because most of the places that we went, we'd meet somebody that Dad knew. And Thomas thinks that that very well could have been the perfect cover for John conducting his activities. You know, unfortunately, spies don't tell tales. And John never told Tom what he was up to. Even on his deathbed, he didn't. And John was the type of person that could keep a secret, so that doesn't surprise me much. But Thomas puts quite a bit of stock in the research I've done. Unfortunately, from his point of view, he can't confirm or deny anything other than fall back on the research that I've done.
At this point, after watching your book, watching you do your research and reading your book, is the son convinced that his father was in the CIA?
I think Tom is. We've talked around it quite a bit, but he's pretty adamant about saying he really can't confirm or deny it. And Tom is a lot like John in that respect. He holds his cards pretty close to his chest, as Tom would tell me about John. And I think he's very proud of his father, if that's what he did. And I think it explains a lot of things that Tom really didn't have answers for before. And Thomas is in the middle of writing his own memoirs now too. So I don't know what he's going to say in that. He's made mention that he very well is going to reference my book in that. So we'll see, but he's warmed to the research, and I can count Thomas Steinbeck as a friend now, if that counts and says for anything.
That's great. Let's take some calls here for you. Let's go to Ken in San Diego, west of the Rockies, to get things started. Go ahead, Ken.
Hi, George. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure thing.
This is a great show. Brian, this is just fascinating. I'm almost floored by this. I've been a big fan and a student of Steinbeck as my favorite author for about 40 years, and I have just never ever heard of this. It's fascinating. But I've got a quick comment and a question. The comment is that I think that my opinion of Steinbeck is that in addition to being a patriot And I think in spite of him living in New York in his later years, I really believe that Steinbeck always was, first and foremost, a real Californian. And, like, along with Jack London, he was, to me, the quintessential California writer. You know, really free-thinking, almost radical in his thinking, but always very loyal to his origins of his state and especially of his country. And that's one of the things I really appreciated about him. But my question is this about him. Given all the anti-communist fervor of the post-World War II era and and given all of Steinbeck's known friendships and meetings that he'd had, that he even documented in his own journals with known communists in the, let's say, communists in the literary intelligentsia of the Depression era, what I'm curious about is why would the CIA have trusted him as a spy in Russia? I mean, wasn't that post-war period a period of real paranoia in the government? And you already mentioned the FBI and Hoover didn't trust him. Why would the CIA have taken a chance on him like that and sent him to Russia? I just thought that they were, you know, persecuting anybody who had any known communist leanings in the Depression era, and Steinbeck was certainly known for that.
Well, I think that goes back to Steinbeck's work with the OSS and the War Information Office during the Second World War. Steinbeck proved his mettle back then. And I think one of the reasons he was never given a commission in the Army was they really wanted to channel his efforts and didn't want him on the ground as a combat soldier. So you've kind of got to look back a little bit to see why they wouldn't give him that opportunity. And he was willing to do it, which I think that cloud of communism also gave him kind of the perfect cover. He's already thought to be part of this communist core. Obviously, his beliefs were not there, and I think the agency could see that. But that also opens him up to having people trust him that might not have trusted a right wing or a person that didn't have those communist connections.
Brian, the book Grapes of Wrath was a must-read for us in high school way back. I wonder what's going on nowadays. Are kids compelled to read the classics like that?
Well, I graduated high school in 1991 and had to read Grapes of Wrath. My son, who is turning 13 next week, I can't believe that, but Robert has had to read Of Mice and Men. So it's still going on. I have a little confession to make. I skipped every other chapter of Grapes of Wrath during high school, you know, the scenes where the turtles crossing the road and talking about the Dust Bowl, because I knew I wouldn't be tested on that, which is kind of ironic now that I end up finding all this stuff out about Steinbeck, and I skipped that back then.
I skipped a few chapters myself. Maybe the ones I skipped are the ones you read and vice versa. We can compare notes one day.
Compare notes. Yeah, there you go.
Next up, we go to our wild card line. It's Jeff in Culver City, California. Hey, Jeff, go ahead.
Hi, George and Mr. Kennard. Yes, it seems that John Steinbeck, whose works, you know, I read as a teenager in 1983, willingly helped the CIA in their work. But I often wondered about those individuals who were unwittingly and unknowingly assisting this agency, especially in those very esoteric, dangerous, and bizarre missions that weren't beneficial to the country of the United States, but were beneficial to certain operatives within the agency or even the agency and its budget itself. Could you comment on this possibility, and I'll take your answer up there?
All right. Sure. Thank you. Sure. Go ahead.
The CIA is as good as it is bad. We've seen egregious misuses of power by the CIA and the HC Legal program, which was a mail opening program, with the MK Ultra and the Phoenix program in Vietnam. So it is a distinct possibility. The nature of covert missions and intelligence gathering is not always pretty. And I'm sure agents have to do things that will wreck someone's life and make them an unwitting pawn. Fortunately, in my research into Steinbeck's life, nothing like that ever popped up. I think Steinbeck was more of a passive intelligence gatherer, except in his trips into Russia. And that's a different story. But luckily, like I said, I don't think Steinbeck would be the type of man that would cotton to those type things, if you will.
Well, look how time has changed too, Brian. I mean, during this era, every American thought the CIA was, you know, pro-government, there for us and everything else. You poll people today about the CIA, and I guarantee you it will be overwhelming that they think the CIA has got its own little drug operation going, that they've assassinated people and all kinds of heinous things. Look how time has changed.
I know. And once again, the intelligence is not a pretty business. And we need to find out some of these things to be able to ascertain if we want a government agency doing these things in our name. So that's one of the reasons I wrote this, was to have people ask those questions, because they're as relevant today as they were in the 1950s.
Yeah, they are. They sure are. Let's go to Appleton, Wisconsin. Neil is with us now. Neil, you're on with Brian Kinnard. Go ahead.
Hello, how you doing? Thanks for taking my call, George. Yeah, you triggered something when you mentioned something about information being leaked from the government to make movies with. And back in the early 80s, I was working for a grocery store who had a security guard overnight, and we'd have coffee with him every morning. Apparently, we always had the police stop by because he had government plates on his car. Now, whenever we sat down with this guy to have coffee, he explained that he was once a Secret Service agent at the time Kennedy was shot. And he had four private investigation firms in four different states. And he would share information with us, and he says, when he got let back into the public, they brainwashed him, but, you know, he said, you don't lose everything. So at the time, Firefox came out, and he said, you know that movie Firefox with Clint Eastwood? I said, yeah, I was a big thrill of it. He says, that plane actually exists. He says, there's information from the government that gets leaked and made movies into, and it's actually true.
Yeah.
And right. I sort of filed all this stuff, you know, away and just not believing in a lot of it until the movie Independence Day came out. When that movie came out, everything that he explained to me or talked about at them coffee dates were actual true events that I imagined in that movie. And it just blew me away.
And I love that movie, too.
I have a stepson who's going to college, interested in getting involved with the CIA and FBI. And, you know, I'm excited for him and everything, but it also concerns me because I think it may be more hurtful for him than it is helpful. Well, is there any advice I could give him that may sway him one way or another?
That's a personal choice. I mean, anyone that goes into service for our country, whether it be in the United States Army or any of the branches of the military or the Coast Guard or even a police officer, they give a lot of their lives up to defend us. And someone like that that's looking into a career in intelligence or in law enforcement needs to have a good sobering look at, you know, the statistics of alcoholism and divorce and that type thing, and realize the personal toll that it's going to take. But some people believe that there's no greater honor than being able to serve your country like that, and it is well worth the sacrifice. And you just have to ask that person those hard questions, and if they can't answer them, that might not be the right lifestyle for them.
Brian, today, do you think there are some people, journalists and movie stars and authors who might be part of the CIA?
Oh, definitely. In 1977, when the Church Commission happened, the CIA stopped recruiting journalists. That didn't mean that they didn't stop using journalists. They just stopped recruiting them. So a journalist can go to the agency now and enlist. Or foreign journalists are not immune to that anti-recruitment rule. That was just for American journalists. I mean, there was a case in 2011 where the New York Times got caught passing some information to the CIA about an article that was going to be written about the Bin Laden affair. And they took a pretty good black eye for that. So it still happens.
So I think if a reporter, for example, is going to be in Libya or Iraq or something, they may go to the CIA and say, hey, you know, I'm going to be out here for about 6 months, and they may tap them for, and just, it's probably one of those, just keep your eyes open. Just tell us what you see and what you hear.
Well, exactly. And that's where people get the misapprehension of someone being a spy and an asset. I mean, there's a huge difference there. I mean, an asset is not a professional intelligence officer. They don't run their own intelligence networks. They're there to gather information. And a lot of times, you're right, it is that passive type intelligence gathering. And I'm sure it happens all the time. The CIA would be foolish not to try to leverage assets like that. Not only are they cost effective, I mean, somebody that's going to be there anyway that's not going to incur any additional risk, why not get information from them? It would be silly not to.
Absolutely. And I've got to tell you, as much as we all criticize, and I'm one of them, the CIA for some of the heinous things they're involved with, we need a great spy agency in this country. I mean, that we must do for a strong defense. And it's unfortunate that some of them are rogue.
It is. And that's once again the nature of covert activity, because just like police officers on a beat, you put a police officer out there to go and make his rounds every night. Well, hopefully he's not sitting in his car asleep. The same thing happens with intelligence officers. You put a huge amount of trust into these people. Their lives are on the line. They're a lot of times in foreign countries. They're lying to the people that they love to keep their covers in a lot of cases. It's a lot of pressure. And yes, bad things are going to happen, but it is a necessary mechanism for our country to defend itself. And once again, we have to ascertain for ourselves, where are those lines that we're willing to cross as a nation to achieve security? And that's a bigger question for another show.
Steinbeck died at 66. What did he die of, Brian?
Actually, heart disease. He was a pretty hard drinker and pretty hard smoker, and passed away right before Christmas. I believe it was December 20th. Tom told me that he got yanked out of Vietnam and got to spend a few hours with John before he passed. And John was in good spirits and passed away in the middle of the night.
Heart attack type
quite peacefully.
Thing?
Yeah, his heart just stopped from all accounts.
Yeah.
So it was, once again, nothing suspicious about that. He'd had health problems for years.
Okay, wasn't killed off. Brian, we're going to come back and take final phone calls with you in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Well, have you watched our television program yet? Beyond Belief, take advantage of it. Great, great guests. They have done some marvelous things with that program. You can look at it for 10 days free and all the other videos that are available when you go to our website, beyondbelief.com. That's www.beyondbelief.com. And welcome back to Coast, Brian Kinnard with us. We'll take your final calls here. Brian, for folks who want to look up the book, Steinbeck, Citizen Spy, it's available at Amazon. How about bookstores? Do they have it?
If they don't, they have the ability to order it. So just ask. You can also go to gravedistractions.com, which is the publishing company that I own. There's information about there, or SteinbeckCitizenSpy.com for places that are carrying the book.
You enjoy doing historical books on events that have truly occurred, like the Steinbeck story. I can tell.
I do. It's a hidden history, and I love the hunt of digging through archives and finding out things that nobody else knows. That's just one of the things that's interested me my entire life, and I'm happiest when I'm doing that.
Good for you. Okay, let's go to some final calls here for you. Let's go next to Craig in Sarasota, Florida, east of the Rockies. Craig, thank you for calling. Go ahead.
Hey, George. Nice to finally talk to you. You guys have a great program going on there.
Thank you, sir.
I had a question. You were talking about the Masons. Now, I know there was a Mason. I'm sorry. There's a Masonry group that I knew of. It was the under Captain Fernando. It was a symbolic.
You're still with us? Well, he's disappeared. The Masons got
okay.
It, Brian. The Masons got it. But why, and I'm sure you've heard this, but why do people think of the Masons as this Illuminati elite group?
Well, I think it's because we're a society with secrets that bars people from, that aren't members from attending our meetings. And there's a natural distrust of anyone that's doing something behind a closed door. Well, fraternities, sororities do the exact same thing every day. And no one bats an eyelash because they're a bunch of college kids. So I think that it's if I don't know exactly what's going on, then I'm distrustful of you phenomena. And it's really just not the case.
What does it mean when they call you a 33-degree Mason?
Well, there's the Blue Lodge in Masonry, which is the first 3 degrees, Intern Apprentice, Fellowcraft, and Master Mason. And no one is a more Mason than anyone else once they reach the degree of Master Mason. There are other bodies like the Shrine and Scottish Rite, and I happen to belong to the Scottish Rite, and that have additional materials that are presented to you. And it just means that you've done something else. I mean, it's not a ranking system. It's not like someone that's a third-degree Mason is a private and a 33rd is a general. And in the Scottish Rite, the 33rd is a honorary degree. You can't ask for it. It's bestowed upon you through your service to the Scottish Rite. So there's, once again, there's nothing funky about it at all. And people that say, well, the 33rds rule the world, and they're the highest type of Mason there is. No, actually, we're all equal. And a Master Mason is just as much a Mason as a 33rd degree Mason. So there's a lot of misconception out there.
Let's go to our first-time caller, Zach in Santa Cruz, California. Zach, go ahead, sir.
Thank you, George.
Hello, Zach.
Yep. Great show. Thank you for coming on, Brian. And I was listening just because you brought on Steinbeck, and it reminded me that I actually did a report back in for business in college where he actually worked for Granite Rock, like, really back in the early 1900s, in 1918, when he was about maybe 16, 17 years old, where he actually worked with Granite Rock and built the Castroville and Moss Landing highway there. And that's why we got the Steinbeck Center right there in Salinas. So I'm wondering if that actually had an influence on him as a writer, and because of that influence, that it made him seen as a recruit prospect for the CIA. You know, you never know how that stuff works.
Well, I think as far as his writing was concerned, John had a number of funky jobs like that. He actually worked on Madison Square Garden as a construction worker in the 20s. So I think that got him in touch with the everyday man and made an impression upon him that, you know, everybody has a story to tell. I don't necessarily think that that was the reason for his recruitment or him volunteering for service with the intelligence agencies that he worked with. I think that was more because of his celebrity status. At one point, in 1940, he presented an idea to FDR to flood the German economy with counterfeit Deutschmarks before we even got in the war, to possibly stop Germany in its tracks. And it was considered for quite a while, but that's kind of the nuclear economic option, and they didn't go through with it. But Steinbeck actually wrote about it in the 50s in an article called The Secret Weapon We Were Afraid to Use, and freshened the concept up for the Cold War. And I don't think that was happenstance. I think that was put out there to give the Soviets another threat to have to guard against. So it very well is a chicken and egg type thing.
He kind of reminds me a little bit of Hemingway, doesn't he?
Well, Hemingway and Steinbeck never got along. They met once and almost got into a fist fight.
Really?
It was at a bar in New York, and Robert Capa, who's a famous war correspondent photographer, was friends with both of them and set the meeting up. And they almost came to blows. But I did find that they are linked somehow prior to their first meeting. In Steinbeck's FBI file, there is a heavily redacted document in March of 1944 that is, the subject line is Hemingway and Steinbeck in Mexico. And I go into a number of possibilities as to what that they might have been working on, because Hemingway actually ran a spy agency in Cuba for the FBI, and watch out for U-boats in the Gulf of Mexico early in the war. So there were a lot of people back then that were involved in the intelligence agency, but Steinbeck was never as brash as Hemingway was. And he was quite understated about his accomplishments, whereas Hemingway was not. So big difference between the two.
All right, let's go to some more final calls here. We go next to Tom in Riverside, California. Tom, thank you. Go ahead.
Hi, George. Hi, Brian. I wanted to ask a question. I'm not impressed with this agency called the CIA these days.
No,
they're probably responsible for John Kennedy and a lot of other things, the 9/11. There's about 2,000 people that really haven't wrote any books and really have no interest in other than the fact that they don't see any way those buildings could have came down the way they did without a little bit of help probably from the CIA. So I have no admiration for the CIA. But one thing I'd like to ask you about this, since you've delved into it, I'm troubled by the fact that George Bush was involved in the CIA. That's Herbert. And he's been suspected probably of some hand in that assassination. You wrote this book, and he was in there about the time Steinbeck would have been involved with that. Is there any connection there? Have you got anything to say about George Bush? And I'm wondering why he isn't brought up more with his tie to the CIA and at that particular time in the early 60s. I'll just take my answer off.
Okay.
Thank you.
Well, George Bush was the director of the CIA after William Colby, and that was long after Steinbeck had passed away. Mm-hmm. And none of my research ever linked Steinbeck to Bush. There were a few other folks that he was linked to. Frederick Prager was one of them, who published books for the CIA, who's linked to E. Howard Hunt. So there's a couple degrees of separation there, but nothing to the Bush family in my research with Steinbeck.
Nothing at all?
Nothing that I could find or that I found. There might be something out there. I mean, you know, of course, research is not 100% exhaustive nor infallible. So there very well could be a connection out there that did not leap out at me.
Let's go to Tina in the state of Washington, D.C. Hi, Tina.
Hi, George. I've been a fan for 18 years, and I've tried to call before, and this
Thanks
is the one time I get through. I love you. I'm an ex-agency spouse, and I can tell you that a lot of what he's saying is true. And to address your previous caller about, you know, the agency being connected to 9/11, I just can't say how insulting that is. I mean, the agency employees and families, people never talk about the families that put their lives on the line, the families that are living undercover in foreign countries, using our children for operations. And that's a dedication to your country that most people have no comprehension of. Now, regarding 9/11, I won't rule out another intelligence agency being connected to that. But
yeah, there's something going on there somewhere.
For sure. And I had a question, real fast, if you have time for your guest.
Yeah, please.
Sure. Do you know what the connection is, or if there is a connection between the Masons and Mormonism?
That's a long debated topic, too. There are some that believe that Mormonism, to a certain extent, is a religion based on some Freemason principles. Unfortunately, I don't know enough about Mormonism to be able to really comment on that. So I would suggest doing some research on your own on that. It's nothing that's ever discussed in Lodge. It's nothing that is in our lore or in our history. So if those that founded Mormonism took some of our symbols or some of our practices and incorporated into Mormonism, that very well might be true. It wouldn't be the first time.
Not at all. Brian, in your research, did you encounter any problems trying to research this book?
Oddly enough, no, other than dealing with government bureaucracy. I got all the information that I got via the Freedom of Information Act, which is as great a tool as it is a bane. Dealing with the exact forms and asking very, very specific questions of these agencies takes a very long time to do and have them answer you. I know my mailman probably freaked out for about 6 months because I was getting stuff from the CIA, from the Department of Justice, from Naval Intelligence. So I'm sure he didn't know what to think about me. But those were the biggest hurdles I had to overcome. Oddly enough, the CIA was easier to deal with than the FBI was, because the FBI has destroyed key documents of redacted portions of Steinbeck's FBI file, which is unconscionable in my mind.
And I think Tina was kind of alluding to this other agency that might be doing stuff. Maybe it was the FBI, huh?
But very well, very possibly so. I mean, once again, I go into detail in the book about why I think the FBI does destroy documents, and I think it's to cover their tracks, because you can't request information on someone until they passed away. So if the FBI sits on something long enough and it's part of their document retention program, let's say we keep documents for 20 years, and all that is cleared through the National Records Administration, they can hide any number of sins by following the guidelines of the NARA and then destroying them before someone dies, and the public is none the wiser. It happened with Walter Cronkite. Most of his file was destroyed. USA Today reported on that. Rosa Parks, the same thing. So our history is slipping away from us, and that's another reason I wrote the book, was to make people aware of that, is we need to speak up about that, because it's unconscionable in this digital age to do that.
Let's grab a quick question from Jim driving in Illinois. Go ahead, Jim.
Yes, thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I'm curious about your guest's knowledge of the celebrity acquisition for CIA. Would you happen to know if Catherine Bell, B-E-L-L, has been approached by the CIA because she's half Iranian and she speaks Farsi? She's the one that was that hot babe on JAG and Army Wives.
Oh, that's right.
I'll take your answer off the phone. Thank you.
Okay. I don't know if you'd know that or not, Brian.
No, I don't. I mean, most of the research I did is ancient history as far as modern day is concerned. I mean, I pretty much ended up about 1977 with the Church Commission looking into this, and most of the activities past then have escaped my attention as far as the book is concerned. But I don't have any real knowledge of agency workings now, and kind of glad I don't.
All right, Brian, I want to thank you for spending the time with us. Great job here on a topic that a lot of people just wouldn't wake up and say, hey, I want to study this. You've done a superb job with this.
Thank you, sir. I had a big time being on. I appreciate you having me.
Steinbeck, Citizen Spy. We're going to come back in a moment. I'll be chatting with Patrick Tucker about his latest work, The Naked Future. What happens in a world that anticipates your every move? That's next on Coast to Coast AM.